It's like those clothes that if you don't wear them but once every couple of years, they look like they're new. Right? Okay, has everybody got a syllabus? It looks like we're okay there. Cool. You what? Silly bus, okay. That's okay. VMEs was silly bus too, but that's a separate issue. All right, let's open with a word of prayer. Oh, Father, we come to you in amazement at the fact that we can actually get together here and talk about you and have some confidence that the information that we're talking about is accurate because you revealed it to us. That we're not pooling our ignorance here as a group, and that we're just coming up with our own interpretations or our own, you know, feelings and opinions and things of this type about what God must be like. But you have instead broken into history and told us some things about yourself, and we still struggle with understanding some of that. We still differ among ourselves about some of the implications of that. But it is not it's an order of magnitude different than what other periods of time and other epochs in civilization, the opportunities that they seem to have had to have a confidence in their knowledge of you. They may have known you, but they did not have the assurance that that knowledge was close. They did not have the comfort. And as we look into your word today at a very specific thing that you did in history, that we might see further into your heart, that you might reveal your character to us even further, and that we would see more of what happened that Friday through the lens of the Day of Atonement in the Old Testament. So prepare our hearts for this and give us strength so that we could see your love, because it's hard to do that sometimes, and your love is so powerful. So help us see that. For your son's sake, amen. Now, we have been going through a torturous amount of detail of all this stuff that apparently I retain, because I don't relearn this every Sunday morning. It does fester during the week. And we have been studying sacrifice. If you remember, we started this process a long, long time ago, and we surveyed all the cultures, and we went through all this minutia, and we looked at the basic fact that everybody has always known, apparently, that things are broken between humans and God. And we have also known that a broken relationship with God is the most serious thing. And we have always known that it was costly, that somehow or another we were going to have to do something. And so in the modern culture, that shows up. You know, in the ancient culture, it showed up as sacrifice, which was nothing more than, you know, your business money, your money to live on. I mean, it was costly. You brought a lamb from your sheep, you know, a lamb from your flock or something of this type. And so it was in the currency of the day. In today's world, we think in terms of sacrifice, not in terms of animals or things of this type. We tend to think, I've got to give something up for God or something of this type, so that many of us would have approached God like this, you know, years or decades ago, where we would have thought, well, you know, I don't know if I want to, approach God, because I'm going to have to stop doing this, I'm going to have to give up this, I'm going to have to take up this, something of this type. We knew that it was costly, and we always assumed, because the brokenness we generally understood was our fault, we assumed that the cost was going to have to be borne by us, that we were going to be the ones to have to do this. And in the best of all possible worlds, perhaps that would have been the case, but we messed up the best of all possible worlds around Genesis 3, real early in the Bible. And so now we're in this other thing, right, this world. They contrast the sweet by and by and the nasty here and now. And this is where we live. And so when we were powerless and without strength, instead of us being able to somehow scrape up enough goodness before God, God just said, this is not going to work. I'm going to have to do something. If this gap is going to be breached, I mean, if this gap is going to be healed, I'm going to have to do it. And that's what Jesus of Nazareth was all about. This is what the nation of Israel was all about. It's what the Day of Atonement was all about, and things of this type. And what we've done, if we've looked at what sacrifice was understood, And in the last couple of weeks, we have been looking at what the Old Testament blueprint was. We've gone through how each one of the various types of sacrifices and offerings that God put into Israel so long ago to make them different from the nations around them, that how they all somehow prefigured or predicted some aspect of the death of Christ. That's Saturday. That's that Friday afternoon. Somehow, something matched up there. And we went through these things, and a lot of these kinds of sacrifices were similar to other sacrifices in other cultures. I mean, there was a certain amount of commonality. And we pointed out over the span of the couple of months that there were certain major differences. And today we're going to come to a rather radical difference, the Day of Atonement. We have looked at the other feast in Israel, and for those of you that are wondering if I'm going to answer the question, yes, we are on an even-numbered page today. It's page 14. And we've gone through each one of the sacrifices that we normally think of in our evangelical subculture. When you mention the word sacrifice, okay, or the death of Christ as a sacrifice, we automatically zoom in on the spectrum of Old Testament sacrifice. We zoom right in to the sin offering. Payment for sin to a breach, to repair the relationship between me and God, okay, between us and God. We all normally think of that because that's fairly critical to our continued breath and life and things of this type and trying to make it through this life. But as we pointed out on numerous occasions, it had a much wider range that the New Testament says Christ did this, he was this, he was this, he was this. Not just this. This is the big one. I mean, this gets perhaps more attention. But the next biggest one is the one we're talking about today. It's one of the celebrated days in Israel's history. Last week we talked about he was the fulfillment of various aspects of the feast. There were three times a year that the Israelite families would travel to Jerusalem. They were generally associated with the end of harvest or the celebration of the Passover, something of this type. And they would come, and there was much rejoicing, and there was much celebration. But the other main feast, actually it's not even a feast, it's a holy day that is specified in the book of Leviticus, is the Day of Atonement. And it is at some level without precedent, at a significant level without precedent in the ancient world. They didn't have a ceremony like this in the ancient world. And the book of Leviticus, which describes this, sort of breaks into two nice pieces. Chapters 1 through 15 roughly describe repairing a relationship with God. So it's got all the offerings and the sacrifices about how to repair a relationship with God. So 1 through 15 is talking about all the offerings and the sin things that we've been talking about, how to repair relationships with God and with other humans in the community. Chapter 17 through the end of the book deal with right living, holy living. How once you've repaired this thing and now you are part of the community and you're living the way you're supposed to be before God, how do you treat one another? And the chapter that's in the middle of that is on the Day of Atonement. There's a chapter right there that has to do with how things get set right within Israel for us to go into continued existence. If remedial work is the first 1 through 16 chapters, okay, and constructive work is the last half, that pivotal was the reboot, the reset button that occurred at the Day of Atonement. Okay, the Day of Atonement was not a feast day. I have... For the past 2 or 3 weeks, this has just dug its way into my heart about the fact that this was by far and away the most important day in Israel's history, and it all rode on one human being, the high priest. Nobody else was involved in this ceremony. You know, all the other feasts, everybody came. Everybody did something. But on the Day of Atonement, no one of the other priests were allowed at the scene. They had to stand outside. Around the nation, that was fasting. They were told to afflict themselves. They were required not to go into the office. They could do no work. Okay? They had to sit there and realize what was at stake. And the ceremony, I'll have to draw a picture of the ceremony for you, how it worked. On the Day of Atonement, it was in the fall, Yom Kippur. Okay, Yom Kippur was in the fall, and it's before the Feast of Tabernacles, which is the great big feast of the year. And on the Day of Atonement, the high priest, Kohen Gadol, he'd pick out a couple of offerings, and he'd pick out a couple for himself and for his sin, and had to be paid for out of his money. By the way, his personal pocket had to pay for his sacrifices; couldn't come out of the temple treasury. Okay, and then he had to have two goats for the nation of Israel. And on that day, the way the later rabbis describe this day, it was of such immense importance that their main issue, the main thing that they worried about, was the cleanliness of the high priest. The high priest changed his garments 8 times. He bathed 5 times during full body bath, which was an exorbitant amount. Just think of the dry skin back in those days, right? And he washed his hands and his feet 10 times during the ceremony. Changed clothes 5 times between the regular priestly garments, of high priestly garments, which had 8 pieces, and then what he was supposed to wear on the Day of Atonement, which was a very simple linen garb that's the normal priest. Okay. On this day, he was like everybody else. He was a sinner. Okay. And the rabbis went to extreme precautions to keep the high priest clean for this day, ritually clean. They would, for example, remove him out of the office for a week before this day so he wouldn't come in contact with people. He would sit in the green chair in front of his computer screen all the time. He would be completely isolated so that nobody could accidentally on him. Okay. One time there was an Arab king that the high priest was visiting with, and he pronounced his pee too strongly. A spittle fell on the high priest, and he was unclean for weeks. They had to find a replacement that was his little brother. This is a rabbinical story. So they would separate this person for a period of a week before this. There were all these the night before, okay? Now, if you remember all the things that made somebody unclean in the Old Testament, okay? The night before, he could not go to sleep. They couldn't let him have dreams that night, okay? And so all night long, they had people reading scripture to him. They wouldn't give him enough food at night, so he'd have his stomach growling to keep him awake until the dawn where he could start the ceremony. And he would have people in there reading scripture to him, engaging him in conversation. They even said what books they read. Job, Esther, and First Chronicles, because those were the least familiar and the least read books. And hopefully that way they would be more engaged with it, because they'd be less familiar with it. They had all these things to keep the priest clean. And then that morning, when the priest is obviously a little drowsy, and so he has to bathe. And it says if he is of weak health, or particularly elderly, they were supposed to warm the water so they weren't cold water baths, because you don't want the high priest dying of shock on the Day of Atonement. Your fallback plans, you know, you've got all those, but you still didn't want to do this. And so what this individual would do when they go to the temple, and then he starts through this, and he has to change every time he moves from this place to this place. Now remember, the temple had 3 areas of holiness. You know, the Holy of Holiness, which you didn't go in. Nobody went in there but the high priest once a year, which means every other day you go in, you don't make it out alive. This whole thing was given after the death of Aaron's sons, who did exactly that. They went in and offered this stuff in the Holy of Holies, died on the spot. Right? Then there's another place, the holy place, and the priests come in and out of this, but not on this day, just the high priest. And then there's the regular temple, the regular court, which even most Israelites could go in. Okay, now, in this, he's going to make trips. The high priest is going to make trips from here into here 2 or 3 times, because he's got to go in once and offer censers. He's got to offer some smoke, okay, so he doesn't die. And in and out, he's going to go this way a couple of times. Every time he's going to change his clothes and bathe. Okay, and they have little linen. They have a linen little booth like a changing room, you know, set up for him to bathe, and people, holy people, to hold his holy garments. Right, very elaborate ritual. And so he disappears from sight. His first trip in, he goes in and he has to offer, of course, the sin for himself and for his household first. He's got to get clean. So he does this. And his first trip in, he goes in and he offers up, you know, for himself, and then he does the little smoke thing. And the smoke thing was supposed to be, he took, you know, coals in with a little bucket, and he put in this incense. It would make a smoke, and it would sort of hide where God was from him so he wouldn't die. In other words, even in their closest, most intimate moment, they still didn't have full access to God. And you still had to hide somewhat, because they were still, you know, unclean on the inside as well. And he would go in and he would, they had a kind of curtain that was like an S shape, sort of like a labyrinth. So nobody would see him. You know, you had to do one of these so that you couldn't see through this confined space. He would go in and make this offering, and then he would say a prayer, and he would come out. And the rabbis say, please don't make the prayer too long so that you won't frighten Israel, that God did not accept you, that we are not his people again. And so one time this guy, the rabbi, that got rebuked. He prayed too long. He came out and said, "Why did you pray so long?" He said, "Well, I was praying for our people." He said, "Don't you know you're not supposed to do that? You scare us. You scare us. We don't know whether God's accepted you or not." And the priests are all on pins and needles. You got to realize the people that were closest to this had the greater sense of God's power and presence. The closer you get to Him, the more you understand that God is not a milksop deity. He has a strong side, shall we say. And He is a quite impressive and awesome God. And therefore, grace means the more you understand this as well. That's a separate issue. But they were the priests that understood this, they saw this. And so he would go through all of these rituals. And the one that we're going to focus on, after he offered the sins for himself, but their biggest issue was the cleanliness of the high priest. He had to be cleaner. It wasn't going to make. It wasn't going to make. Okay. Now, also in this ceremony, remember he had a standard kind of sin offering for himself and for his household. But then they had two goats. So they would take two goats, roughly identical goats, and then they would cast lots, because there were two parts of the ceremony that were not used in any other ceremonies, by the way. They would they had a little urn, a golden urn. Originally it was made of wood, but somebody made it a gold later. And he would draw in his hand, he'd pull out a lot, and one of the goats was going to be sacrificed to Yahweh there on the temple for the sins of Israel. The other one was going to be, they said, for Azazel, which is out in the desert. It's going to, actually, in rabbinical thing, is going to be pushed off a cliff out in the desert and die. Now, so they would decide which one was which, by casting lots. So they'd pull this up, and then they'd tie a little red crimson cord on one of them to distinguish the two goats so that they know which one was which. And then they would sacrifice the first goat, and then he would go take the blood of the goat for Israel. And what they would do with the goats, by the way, is they would do the laying on of hands, identification. So the high priest would go over after he was theoretically clean, put hands on the goat and confess over the goat the sins of Israel, all of them, intentional, unintentional, whatever. Everything was supposed to be confessed there. And generally, it's general categories. Sometimes it's a national sin. Sometimes it's tribal, things of this type. He would confess and put the sins on the goat, so to speak. Okay, and then the goat would be a sacrifice, going with the blood to the Holy of Holies, and sprinkle it up and down seven times or so, actually a total of eight, and God would accept that. Then he would come out, and then they have what they call the second goat, which is the scapegoat, which comes from the English escape, because it's going to escape into the wilderness, so to speak, and goat. And then they would take this goat, he would do the same thing, hands on the head, confess over it the sins of Israel. And then there was a holy person assigned, not necessarily a priest, but a holy person, that would take the goat out into the desert to Azazel. And what that meant was outside the camp, and back in the rabbinical days, before the destruction of the temple, they had little sentry outposts. They had little booths, they looked like toll booths, that would give food and water to the traveler that was carrying the goat as they would go to the cliff. And Azazel, according to the rabbinics, was a long, large cliff. And at the end of the routine, each time that they would come to a toll booth, the person that was in the toll booth would walk with the party, and the person that came from the previous toll booth would sit there until you got to the last toll booth, and then only the clean person and the goat could go to the edge of the cliff where he pushed the animal off the cliff, and the animal died out in the wilderness. Okay, then what would happen then is that he would wave back to the booth. And then each booth would signal down the chain of booths to the high priest so they knew that that part of the ceremony was done so they could finish the Day of Atonement. Okay, this was this important to Israel. Israel knew that this was a big, big issue. Yes?
What is the time frame that you're speaking of when this ceremony occurred, and where was the Ark of the Covenant?
Okay, the first question was, it started at daybreak when it's...
Year what?
Oh, it ran from approximately, well, we don't know how well it was celebrated, but it was inaugurated either 1400 BC or 1200 BC and ran until 70 AD at the destruction of the temple. And it would have been changed over time slightly with some of these elements. It took basically most of the day for this to occur. The Ark of the Covenant, of course, was on the very inside okay, until it was captured by the Babylonians. After the Babylonians, there was no Ark of the Covenant. Remember, it was gone. But they put a stone slab where the Ark was in memory of the Ark between Babylon and the destruction of the temple. Good question. So this ceremony proceeds like this, and then at the end of that, they have the priest actually has a meal, presumably gets to go to sleep, right? And this ceremony was, like I say, pins and needles for these people. The issue of whether God would write things again and give Israel another year. There were certain sins that were only forgiven at the Day of Atonement, for example. There were certain crimes that were only forgiven at the Day of Atonement. It was a big deal. It was a big deal. But the whole the nation, it wrote, the fact that I kept coming back, it was just one dude, the high priest. Nobody else counted in the ceremony. Everything else, the celebration, was for everybody. But the work of the atonement was one guy. So that's the backdrop, the Day of Atonement, going into the New Testament, the person of Christ. And in the person of Christ, you're going to see that the New Testament says not only is he both goats and the high priest, and is he on the ark, Yahweh, and is he the temple. And it was the whole thing, right? He did every scrap of the work that was required from him.
Last week, I think, when you said that on the day of Pentecost, when the Spirit, all of this that was written,
right. Now, and we'll talk about that, because part of his point was about the fact that all this external law was at Pentecost. All of a sudden, I will write the new covenant. Remember, was said that, you know, I gave you a set of rules, but you just didn't have it inside to make it happen. So what I'm going to do in the new covenant is I'm going to put it inside. So some of this comes naturally in response, and we'll see some of the transformation that occurs. In just a few minutes. We've got about one page of verses, and then we're going to go through here. And look at we're on page 14, starting at the middle, the high priest. So these are the passages that apply to Jesus being the high priest. Now, most of this stuff, I mean, we could, with profit, just read the book of Hebrews here, because most of this comes from Hebrews, because it defines this. I mean, it describes this. It's seen this finally. It's beginning to understand what this was all about. And it says, basically, if you had to sum what Hebrews was in one word, it's wow. Wow. You know, how much more. The two phrases that are dominant in Hebrews that we don't have in tons of other places. One is how much more, how much greater, how much better is Christ than the new than the old. And the other one is this Greek word called hapax, which means once and for all. It occurs like six times in Hebrews. And it's just very, very rare in Greek, just once and for all, just done. Then repeat it, no need for it, have facts. And we'll see this in a couple of verses as we go through, but it's certainly a while. The high priest, and not through the blood of goats and calves, but through his own blood, he entered the holy place once for all, having obtained eternal redemption. All right, so here's the verse. Instead of using an animal's blood, this priest used his own blood. All right, so he was his own sacrifice as the priest. Therefore, Jesus also, that he might sanctify the people through his own blood, suffered outside the gate. Now, we've got to talk about suffering outside the gate. All right, remember how we had the two goats? And what happens here is that they separate the widest space in all of history. All of the other sacrifices occur in this second area. Remember, we had the Holy of Holies, we had the Holy, and then we had the court. Okay? All the other sacrifices occur here. This is the only time in Israel's history where a sacrifice penetrates closest to God, Holy of Holies, and the only time it is that far away, totally far away. As far as the east is from the west, so has he removed our transgressions from us. Right? So we have a picture of all of the space here covered by this one day. Well, The goat that was slain inside the temple as for Israel's sin, normally you would burn it there at the altar. You normally burn it at the altar, but in this particular case, they were required to take it outside the gate. Now, outside the gate is where everything unclean was. If you had an infectious skin disease and you were in quarantine, you went outside the gate. Okay, and so there was a separate area outside the gate where things unclean went. And so the writer of Hebrews points out that, you know, these sacrifices, instead of just normally being burned on the altar, because they carried the sin of Israel, they were really unclean. They were burned outside the gate. And his point here was that Christ also, at the depth of this, bearing our sin as a world and as a nation, and the nation of Israel, bore this sin outside the gate. So he went as far out as you could get in terms of holy space, the definitions of holy space. He might sanctify the people, which just means set them apart, say they're different, through his own blood suffered outside the gate. For it was fitting that we should have such a high priest, holy, innocent, undefiled, separated from sinners and exalted above the heavens, who does not need daily, like those high priests, to offer up sacrifices first for his own sins and then for the sins of the people, because this he did once for all when he offered up himself. Now, if the main problem for Israel at the time that the rabbis wrote was keeping the high priest clean, what would this have seemed like to a Jewish person reading this? That here was a priest that didn't, we don't have to worry about that. Undefiled, no sin, nothing. Don't have to worry about it. What a relief. Yes, sir?
How did Jesus suffer from his own blood outside the...
Yeah, the crucifixion occurred outside the gates of Jerusalem. Yeah.
They're talking about the crucifixion.
Correct. Absolutely. Good point. Because this is the sacrifice that he's bearing the sin. And if you remember history, good question. The history was inside Jerusalem was where the judgment was made. He was condemned by both the Jewish authorities and the religious authorities and abandoned by the quote-unquote future Christian authorities. Okay, everybody said no. Okay, which, by the way, is the complete opposite of the Day of Atonement, where everybody's trying to hold the high priest up. Remember, they're reading to him, trying to keep him awake. They're watching him. They change shifts. They change shifts. They do all this stuff to try to keep this fragile, fragile, weak link in the chain together, right?
But
right, can't even stay awake with the subtlety there.
Was there any truth to the story that I heard about putting some sort of a feather on the high priest? So if he didn't, if he was killed, then, in other words, he wasn't properly cleansed and so forth, they could drag him out and they wouldn't have a dead body there by the...
Right. Yeah, I have not heard that one before. I haven't seen it in rabbinics. Now, that may be in the later Midrash, but it's not like the Talmud. Right. Now, they did have a problem that, for example, one of the high priests were Sadducees, if you remember. The priests at the time were Sadducees, which weren't the most, they weren't as holy as the Pharisees, so to speak, right? So they would sometimes play a little fast and loose with the law. So the Pharisees, when they're writing the story of one of the Sadducee high priests, said he was going to change the rules. It's time to reform this system. So he does the censor in a different place. He goes in, God accepts the atonement, but kills the high priest within 3 days. He's stricken as soon as he walks out. Perhaps they would have needed a tether, but perhaps God just lets him get out so they don't have that problem of needing the tether. But he died within like 3 days, a horrible, you know, grotesque death kind of thing in the rabbinical literature. But it was an issue. You did have to, you know, play with the program. Now, the judgment occurred in the city, but he did go outside the gate. In other words, crucifixions occurred outside, you know, a little hill, you know, we call Calvary and Golgotha, the place of the skull. And it was done for that reason, so that it wouldn't defile the city. Good question. Good question. So it was, that was where the crucifixion occurred and where the sacrifice, so to speak, occurred there. Good question. So he's clean. He does not need daily to offer up for his own sins. He did, and then for the sins of the people, he did this once for all. There's that word halfax when he offered up himself. I mean, he was that once and for all. Next verse, but he, having offered one sacrifice for sins for all time, sat down at the right hand of God, waiting from that time onward till his enemies be made a footstool for his feet. Now, when the high priest was offering sacrifices, was he seated or was he standing? He was standing, because everything was built like this. They were always standing, there was always moving around, there was always the stuff you had to do. You only sat down when it was over. When it was over. So the point of the Hebrews, it says, when it's over, he sat down. It's done. It is done. We don't have to do this again next year. It's over. It's done. Half acts. Once and for all. Access is there. Okay? It's that complete. This is why it's a wow thing to somebody that was familiar with this. The temple was still standing at the time Hebrews was written. They were still doing this. They were still doing the ceremony. And he said, wow. He said, wow. By the way, we have one post-ascension scene where Jesus is actually standing up. Where is that? Up in heaven. We have a vision of somebody where he stands up instead of sits down. Where is that? The stoning of Stephen. Okay. It was a gesture of honor to receive a fallen hero. Gesture of honor to receive nobility would be to rise. And the condescension for the Son of God to rise at the stoning of Stephen, just one of us, right, is called grace. It's called grace. Grace means it's unexpected. It's unexpected goodness on the part of God. Also unmerited and all the other theological things, but if it's unmerited, it's also unexpected. When he had made purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. He had purified the sin, that's all dealt with, and he sat down. So the author of Hebrews was pointing out that he was both the high priest that did this for the world, and he was also his own sacrifice for the sins of the nation. Now we get into the two goats. So the slain goat, the first one, we've seen this once already, but not through the blood of goats and calves, but through his own blood he entered the holy place once for all, Hephax, having obtained eternal redemption. Okay, he went in there. Since therefore, brethren, we have confidence to enter the holy place by the blood of Jesus. Now, there's a transition here. The point was is that he entered with this sin, the blood of this goat. Okay, it was his own in this particular case, so he is that goat. But then we get the fact that we have confidence to enter the holy place. This is new. Remember, the high priest could only go in once a year. And even then, he had to hide while he was in there. See? What's going to end up happening here is that we're going to, and I don't have the verses here in front of you here, but it's going to say that we have the confidence to enter the Holy of Holies, having our bodies washed with pure water and our consciences sprinkled. Okay? In other words, the closeness that the high priest couldn't even have them. Little people like us have. See? There's somebody in there that's on our side that says, hey, access, you don't even have to hide when you come in the presence of God. And if you feel guilty, just look at the blood that's down here at the bottom of the altar. Right there at the foot of the cross. Look at that and remember whose that was. So there's a level of access that the New Testament believer has that the Old Testament high priest did not have. See? And the writer of Hebrews makes this point. He explicitly says, you know, the way into the holiest was not yet, we didn't know. We couldn't tell. God promised a better thing to us. They looked for it. They anticipated it. They had a walk with God, a relationship with God, but nothing like the new covenant. Even Paul talks about the glories of the new covenant. I will write my laws within you. We're going to have a level of intimacy that's unparalleled in the history of humanity with God. Okay? And you get this rather interesting thing of what used to just buy us safety outside the tent, this Day of Atonement, where once a time we went through this elaborate, and what that did meant that I could come into the second one without being killed. Excuse me, not all of us, just the little priestly families could come in there. But that I could come over into the court of the common folk every now and then with my little sacrifices, but certainly I could hang out with Israel and not be killed. Right? Where that was the best case scenario in the Old Testament. The best case scenario in the New Testament is that you wake up every morning and spend time with the living God. You don't have to be afraid. You don't even have to bathe before devotion. You just go straight in. You go straight in. Kierkegaard, as this passionate individual, talks about how this would make you go crazy if you really realized this. He said, you know, the common person would think it's sort of vain or, you know, presumptuous for him to even have an audience with their local king or to be in the presence of a president. To have the God of the universe that you are intimate with. He said, if you really saw this, you'd probably go crazy. You'd probably go crazy. And This is not what the ancient world expects. This is not what we expect. Occasionally we tap into this. Twice a year, we see this, we sense this, you know. But we just don't do this enough. We don't do this enough. And he went to a lot of trouble so we could do this. A lot of trouble so we could understand this. So the slain goat, like I say, and this cleared this path. And then the scapegoat. And you know that he appeared in order to take away sins, not just to forgive, which is what the first goat did, but to take away sins, to actually remove them. So Christ also, having been offered once to bear the sins of many, you know, the confession, laying on of hands, the identification ceremony, transference actually in that particular case, he was also that scapegoat. And so that the two elements that occurred, across were both the fact that he, and actually at the cross, there's some ambiguity as to when this occurred. We're not sure exactly. But we know that suffering outside the gate, that this was when he was, my God, why have you forsaken me? Okay, this was the driving away, the time where God had to turn his back on his son for those couple of hours. And then there's the time that he actually goes up and presents the offering. You remember when after he rises from the dead and Mary greets him, he says, don't, you know, touch me. I have not yet ascended to the Father. Right? And we're not sure exactly what that means, but most people, evangelical commentators, believe that that means that, you know, I can't touch anybody yet. I'm completely, you know, clean, and I have to go present this up in heaven, the ascension. And it was either the ascension within the couple of days there or at Pentecost. A couple of days later. So there's that. He appeared in heaven, according to the book of Hebrews, the author of Hebrews, that he took his own blood, his own offering. He went up, and it says that basically cleansed heaven. Okay, that he said that the Old Testament laws had to do with cleansing the earthly tabernacle. And the earthly tabernacle were a copy of that in the heaven. Copies of that in the heaven. And so the author of Hebrews, if you know, just go read this, be like the Bereans and go check this out yourself, talks about, therefore, the heavenly tabernacle had to be cleansed with better offerings. That's what Hebrews said. Right? And so that there, and we won't come back to that verse for a couple of years, okay? Because remember, we're going through sacrifice and redemption and reconciliation, and we're going through all the different words for the cross, and we won't get triumphed over the evil powers until like number 16. So we're talking years out here, okay? Right. That we'll come back to this first. So, but you can study it on your own if you want to between now and then. Well, it had become defiled in some way. I mean, because it said it had to be cleansed with a better offering. Now, when you reflect upon that, you have to think about this. That the heavenly tabernacle is not an eternal tabernacle, per se. In other words, it necessarily hadn't been there from all eternity past or eternity future, because it said it was set up in the heavenlies. So God set it up in the heavenlies. So it was perhaps, you know, part of history as opposed to something all in eternity. In other words, God set up authorities, he set up structures in the world, and things of this type. And somehow what either we did and the evil angels did, some combination of that reached all the way up. All the way up. See, we don't normally think, like I say, down here, we're too dull. We don't take this real seriously. We don't take evil and these things really, really, you know, we don't see them as destructive as perhaps they are, you know, as presumably they are. But that's the second thing. But if you look at, like, he sees it as violence. You know, we use strange metaphors in the Western world, but if I were to, you know, sin is not dark. It is not black. What color is sin? It is scarlet. It is crimson. It is the color of fresh blood. And sin is called having bloody hands. And sin is destructive. It kills. It does things. And it may not look like it today, but it will. It does. Be sure your sin will find you out like a jaguar that hunts you down. Right? like the leopard. And so it's destructive, and it's pervasive. I mean, we'll talk about in just a minute about how this ripples down and what the Day of Atonement did for this.
You were talking about Jesus saying to Mary, "Don't touch me." But a week or so later in the upper room,
right.
Thomas, Jesus
right.
said, "Put your finger in my hand
exactly.
and in my side and so forth." So he must have done the cleansing
right.
in between that.
That's why I'm saying there's a little bit of, you know, ambiguity as to when it occurred, whether he, you know, because he also had breakfast with them, remember, and he would have been passing food around. And we're not sure exactly what the reference to, don't touch me, I've not yet seen the Father, whether it occurred later that day or what. Yeah, there's some, we don't have enough timeline there, but that's actually, that's absolutely the truth. So we had some level where he appeared in heaven on our behalf in between those. He went straight to heaven, okay, upon his death, his spirit. Because who went with him that day? The thief on the cross. Remember that one of the thieves on the cross, you know, was bad-mouthing him. And the other one said, remembering when you come into your kingdom, simple act of faith, deathbed conversion, we would call it. And Jesus stopped what he was doing. Right? And said, this day. And he ministered to the guy next to him. Said, I'll take a few minutes off this. This day you will be with me in paradise. This day you will be with me in paradise. Now, did that guy raise from the dead? No, probably not. But he in his heart and his spirit was somewhere with Jesus called paradise that day. And so there, for the two paragraphs we have in the New Testament about what happened during this period, for those two paragraphs we have 2,000 pages of speculative writings that occurred in the next 400 years about where all Jesus went during these hours. Okay, I mean, believe me, that the imagination is wonderful for filling in gaps. And we are, as a people, we are very superstitious. We always have been, always will be. And so we only have limited data about what actually occurred within that sequence of events and things of this type. But what you get is the scenario whereas over the course of the year, Israel would consistently earn the censure of God, consistently in their history. They were not the most faithful in doing sacrifices. They were not the most faithful at doing confession. The average Israelite of the day maybe wasn't even a monotheist. They still were sacrificing to goat idols out in the fields in Leviticus. They had to say, stop doing this. Stop doing this. Okay? And so it's a mixed crowd, just like us. We're at various stages of our spiritual journey and progressive sanctification, okay, and things of this type, right? And so the average Israelite, or some of the Israelites, would have walked by the temple. Let's say the high priest was spectacularly successful in the Old Testament and the way was cut. Remember how when Jesus died, the curtain of the temple that separated God from us ripped, remember? And the author points out it ripped from the top down. God took the knife. God, come on in. Where it's warm. Where it's safe. Where there's renewal. You know as well as I do, you need to be changed every day. Every day. Where is it? And so, in the Old Testament, if the high priest had been spectacular and ripped that apart, how many of us had a bar, you know, a marquee, a board that said, access is free, no payment, no. How many of us would have taken off from our just daily work and gone in? How many of us do it now? How many of us do it now, right? And so it was still the people that were inside, the people that were closer to God, the priests, they knew. Remember, they were afraid. They were afraid of this day. God wasn't going to allow this to happen, that Israel all of a sudden was going to be alone in the ancient world against enemies that were considerably stronger and more powerful than she. Okay? And that the average Israelite, who was constantly harassed, not by foreign powers, but by the fellow human being, because when David, the king, writes tons of the Psalms, and he's sitting there saying, deliver me from those who are my friends, who worship with me in the temple, who walked with me in pilgrimage, the treachery within human relationships. These are the enemies that hurt us the most. These are the enemies that hurt us the most. And so, access was depended upon this one individual. So when we get to the New Testament, the book of Hebrews comes to this and says, wow, see, this is free. And so when we have our bodies sprinkled and consciences cleansed, we have that level of intimacy of the high priest to get to this God and access the source of relationships. I remember thinking one time, you know, back at, you know, very early, thinking, you know, somebody made the comment about the Bible being the owner's manual to life. You know, that if you want to know how sort of life worked, just read the instructions. Read the documentation. It's not online help, okay? But it's you just have to sort of get prepared for how you're going to deal with a certain situation. And I remember thinking that, maybe even reading somewhere, that I need certain relationships to be working for me to have strength to go into other relationships. Okay? Most of you would experience this. I need a close friend sometimes to encourage me enough for me to charge into not so close friends scenarios because of the risk of treachery and pain. Right? And relationships that are good and solid empower you to go take those personal risks for more relationships. And if those work, you go further out and you become an outie as opposed to an in. Okay? And I remember realizing that, oh, and if the primary relationship that every creature has is to the God who made them, why would it be surprised that we're not where we need to be? Why would we be surprised that we don't have as much power, as much comfort, or live in as much compassion, that aggressive compassion kind, you know? Goes out there and takes risk and does stuff. You know, and it's a function of what well do you drink at? What well do you drink at? And so the fact that God said, you know, I got to make this easy. I got to make it more than free. I got to make it aggressive. I got to show on the cross what I'm like. And I'm not arrogant. I'm not monarchical. I'm not distant. I live where you are. Where you are. I suffer outside the camp. No temptation has taken you, but it's not common to all men. He was tempted in all points like us, yet he was without sin. I remember one time that when I was naive, more naive. More naive. Where's that smoke when you need it? Right. When I was more naive, I was thinking, well, yeah, but he never sinned. Never really tasted what this was like. And somebody pointed out, said, well, you haven't tasted what it's like either, because if you had stood out a little longer, the temptation had gotten harder. And it doesn't get really strong until the very, very end. So those of us that give up early, you know, we haven't tasted the full power of temptation and suffering and evil like that would have been. Oh, no, at the end of the trial. In other words, like Jesus in the wilderness, for example, the 40 days of being tested, right? It's only at the very end when he has survived that, when the temptation goes away, when the tempter leaves him. Yeah, good question. Good question. It's that most of us, like I say, we don't taste the full bit. And it's only the purest heart, of course, that feels most of the pain of it. See, most of us are dulled by various and sundry other things, you know, and reused and stuff like this. And the fact that he... all the way to the end, remember the night, you know, the agony in the garden, drops of blood, resisted unto death is what Hebrews talks about. This was the high priest for us, one that broke into there, did this access, and we have this access on the basis of this. And we're going to start summarizing next week on try to wrap up what this was all about, what was the whole point of this wide system, and I'll try to do it without repeating everything I've said in the last, you know, 14 weeks or whatever it was. I'll do my best. But this one about the Day of Atonement, it's got to be the most incredible picture of the fact that everything was done by God on this. In other words, we as humans have no excuse not to avail ourselves of a resource and a personal warmth that Paul has to pray. I pray that your heart would be strong enough to perceive the love of Christ. And we don't get real close to that very often. I remember as a seminary student, you know, they assign you passages to preach on, right? Two. And one of the passages I got was that one. And so you had to spend some 80, 120 hours on these like three verses, three or four verses. and you were in the Greek, and you were just really digging into this stuff, you know, to prepare your sermon thing. And you really immersed yourself in the text, because you weren't allowed to use notes. And you got up there in your little 20-minute moment of glory. You had no notes, and you had nobody to give you nonverbal feedback like all you people are precious to me about. All you had was the one guy that was going to go after you, and the double PhD in the back cutting the videotape on the audio track, ripping you to shreds with your delivery or your content or something like this to give you constructive feedback. And I remember getting into this thing where it says, you know, I pray that you'd be strong enough to comprehend the height and depth and breadth and width of the love of Christ. The more I reflected upon that, the more it just carved a hole in me. And I just ain't been the same since. I mean, I know that's a scary place to go. I mean, because it'll burn you to think about the love of Christ that much. It'll just blow you away, and you won't be functional for 6 hours. You won't be able to go back to work sometimes. And so I know what they're talking about the praying for strength, that your heart to be strengthened to know about this love. And so this is what I pray for daily. You don't have the strength to see His love, right? And so a picture of this, one Hebrew driver, Brown, Driver, and Briggs, if you know the standard Hebrew lexicon, if he's one of these Old Testament things, said the Day of Atonement was the Good Friday of the Old Testament. Everybody saw everything was right there, riding on one individual. Like I say, they were trying to hold the high priest up so that the nation could continue its existence. And this is the God that has broken into history in the person of Christ, laid it out there for us so that we can have free access to this warmth. And we come not in fear. Not in fear. Because he knows we're ignorant. And the psalmist says he knows that we are but dust. This, he wants us to know this kind of God. Let's close in a word of prayer. Father, what can we say? You gave us a really clear picture, the Old Testament. You taught us that a lot was at stake here, a lot was at issue. But then when you actually showed us in history the person of your Son, what can we say but wow? And if we're sane, we'll say, I want some of that. I want some of that. We want some of you, God. Father, we want to draw close. We want to experience the renewal. We want the influx of new life and new creativity and new ideas and new starts and fresh beginnings in our lives that comes from being inside that Holy of Holies, close and intimate with you. Help us remember this daily, all day long. Help us to be aware that we have access by grace, freely, without fear, your presence. And help us to pause and thank your Son for this, for the costliness of that Friday. Thank you so much for this and our time together today. And may we brood about this week. May this change us. May this draw us closer to the source of our strength for our relationships, stronger for the source of renewal in our lives, and to impact our world around us, beginning with ourselves and our family and our work and our community, and that we might honor you and show forth the heart and strengthen our hearts, that we might see the love that led that one, the Lamb of God, to the cross. I pray, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. For His sake we pray. Amen.